Okay, let's unpack this. We've all heard those dazzling startup stories, right? The ones that promise to revolutionize an entire industry, attract massive funding, and then, well, sometimes they just fizzle out, sometimes spectacularly.
Yeah, exactly.
But what if some of those stories, were built on something less than solid? What if at their core they were founded on what we're calling fake products?
Indeed. And the allure, the temptation really, of presenting this polished, high fidelity product, especially in those breathless early stages of a startup, it can be incredibly strong.
Right.
There's just immense pressure to impress partners, investors, to really stand out in what's often a very crowded, competitive market. But this approach, well, if it involves misrepresenting what's actually built or, what capabilities truly exist, it carries really significant ethical, legal, and frankly, severe reputational risks. We've seen the devastating fallout from that gamble.
And that's exactly what we're diving into today, because we're not just talking about like an ambitious vision here. We'll explore that critical, often misunderstood difference between building a real, even if it's minimal, product, something tangible, something functional, and falling headfirst into that really dangerous fake product trap. Our mission today is to equip you with robust, lean MVP tactics, strategies that will allow you to build genuinely valuable products, from the ground up, things that foster trust and long-term success. And we'll also shine a bright light on the severe consequences that inevitably come from misrepresentation. We'll draw on some truly eye-opening case studies that have made headlines recently.
Really?
So think of this deep dive as your shortcut, maybe, to understanding how to build trust and achieve sustainable growth, not just, fleeting hype. We've gathered insights from comprehensive guides on lean and agile UX, deep dives into early AI startup strategies, and extensive reports detailing those high-profile startup scandals that have really reshaped how we think about innovation.
What's truly fascinating here, and I think often counterintuitive for new founders, is how the path to genuine lasting innovation often involves a far more humble reality-based approach than many might initially imagine.
Humble, yeah, not flashy.
Exactly. This deep dive will hopefully illuminate why showing something that truly works, even if it's limited in scope or maybe its functionality, is just exponentially more powerful and trustworthy than some glossy illusion designed simply to impress. The key really lies in understanding that demonstrating tangible, verifiable progress, however small it might seem, it de-risks a venture in the eyes of savvy investors and critical partners far more effectively than, any amount of bluster or exaggerated claims. It's really about substance over flash.
The perilous fake product trap and its devastating fallout.
So let's get right into the heart of the problem, then. What exactly do we mean by a fake product? Because, like you said, it's more than just an ambitious vision, right? We're not talking about a grand idea that hasn't fully materialized yet or, a roadmap that's still being developed. Where's the line? Where does ambition cross into, deception?
Precisely. And in the context of early stage startups, particularly within those fast-paced, often hype-driven domains like software and artificial intelligence,
Especially AI right now.
especially AI, a fake product often refers to presenting this high-fidelity, really polished product, or maybe a demo that either has no real underlying functionality at all, or perhaps more commonly, its capabilities are just grossly fundamentally exaggerated. It's really about misrepresenting the actual product readiness or the core technology. So this isn't just about an aspirational roadmap or some future vision. It's about actively showcasing something that fundamentally doesn't exist or, doesn't work as claimed right now. It's a deliberate act of misdirection.
That makes a lot of sense. So it sounds like it's about telling a good story, maybe, without necessarily being able to show it works. Prioritizing that compelling narrative over the actual demonstrable proof.
Exactly. That's the core of it. The temptation is just enormous, to use impressive mock-ups, slick videos, sophisticated prototypes that are frankly just facades, or wildly inflated claims to attract stakeholders quickly. And this is especially true when you're under that intense pressure to secure early funding, what we call pre-seed or seed investment.
Right, the very first money in.
Typically the very first capital a startup raises, often before they've even proven genuine genuine product market fit.
Yeah.
And you also desperately need to land those crucial design partners.
Okay, what are those exactly?
Those are your early customers, especially in big enterprise or maybe government sectors. They work closely with you to shape the product. They give invaluable feedback, act as early validators, and hopefully become future advocates.
Got it. So high stakes.
Very high stakes. And this fake it approach feels like a shortcut, but it's a highly risky gamble because it prioritizes illusion over substance, over actual verifiable results. It's almost always a short-term gain for what turns into a long-term, often catastrophic, loss.
So why? Why do founders fall into this trap? Is it purely about the money, securing funding, or getting those big partners? There must be a powerful psychological pull, right? Beyond just the obvious incentives.
Well, often, yes, securing funding and partners are major drivers, absolutely. But it does go deeper. There's just immense pressure on early stage startups to demonstrate significant, like, accelerated progress and market readiness that simply isn't there yet.
Right. The timeline feels impossible.
Exactly. Founders might genuinely feel that without a polished, seemingly complete product, they just won't stand out from the noise. You know, from the thousands of other startups pitching. They worry they won't secure the necessary buy-in from investors who are just inundated with pitches every single day. The fear is that a truly minimal, honest prototype might be perceived as too basic, too simple, or maybe just not exciting enough to capture attention in that hyper-competitive environment. It feels like a perceived necessity to compete, even if it means compromising integrity.
It's almost like a fear of being perceived as not ready or maybe too small. So they overcompensate with, like you said, exaggeration.
Yeah.
Believing they need to project this image of being further along, maybe hoping they can just catch up to the illusion later.
That's a very accurate way to put it. Yeah. They feel compelled to present a product that looks and feels like it's ready for prime time, even if, you know, behind the scenes, it's held together with duct tape, manual processes, and frankly, wishful thinking.
Uh-huh.
However, and this is the absolutely crucial point, the dangers of misrepresenting product readiness are not hypothetical. They're very real. We have seen repeatedly how this path leads to severe ethical, legal, and financial repercussions. Just look at the number of high-profile startup scandals that have unfolded, really just between 2021 and 2025 alone. These cases really underscore that investors and partners, they're increasingly looking for tangible proof of concept, not just a glossy concept or a compelling story. They've been burned before, you know? They're much savvier now.
And we've certainly seen some truly spectacular implosions from this whole fake it till you make it philosophy gone wrong. Let's dive into some of those cautionary tales just to really see what happens when product reality doesn't match the public narrative. First up, probably the most notorious, Theranos.
Yeah.
In a health tech.
Yeah.
This one's almost become legend, hasn't it?
Yes, Theranos. It basically became synonymous with startup fraud. This company promised to completely revolutionize blood testing with its Edison device. They claimed it could run a huge range of diagnostic tests accurately from just like a few drops of blood.
Incredible claim.
An incredible claim. It was a narrative of breakthrough innovation that just captured imaginations and attracted significant investment, including from, you know, highly respected individuals and institutions.
But the reality, as we all know now, was starkly, criminally different. The technology simply never worked as advertised.
Never.
Instead, Theranos secretly ran most of its patient tests on standard third-party lab machines while actively, deliberately giving false assurances to its investors and crucial partners like Walgreens. This wasn't just an ambitious vision that failed. This was active, widespread deception.
Precisely. And the company peaked at an astonishing $9 billion valuation. Just a truly staggering figure built entirely on this illusion.
$9 billion, wow.
But then relentless investigations by the Wall Street Journal, starting back in 2015, systematically revealed the deception. And that triggered a cascade of regulatory probes and legal actions.
Mm-hmm.
Founder Elizabeth Holmes and her COO, Ramesh Sunibalwani, were subsequently indicted on federal fraud charges in 2018. Holmes was convicted in 2022, sentenced to over 11 years in prison. Balwani received nearly 13 years.
It's your time.
Very serious. And the company itself, once so lauded, just dissolved in 2018, leaving behind this trail of ruined reputations and billions in lost capital. This case became the quintessential example of startup dishonesty, often called Silicon Valley's biggest fraud. And it profoundly sparked widespread scrutiny of that whole fake it till you make it culture. It fundamentally shifted how investors and the public view audacious startup claims.
Yeah, it really did. Moving from healthcare to electric vehicles, let's look at Nikola, another striking example of misrepresentation. But this time, with a, you know, a physical product, a truck.
Right, Nicola. And its flamboyant founder, Trevor Milton. They repeatedly misrepresented the readiness and the capabilities of their prototype electric vehicles and the associated technology, specifically hydrogen fuel cell and battery electric trucks. They created this very compelling vision for the future of trucking, promising to disrupt the entire industry.
But the reality was, again, very different from the slick marketing. There's that infamous 2018 promotional video, right, of its Nikola One semi-truck supposedly in motion.
Oh, yes. The truck was actually just rolling downhill with no functioning drivetrain whatsoever. It wasn't driving under its own power.
They pushed it up.
He literally pushed it up a hill and then let it roll down for the cameras. Milton also falsely claimed Nikola had built a truck from the ground up and developed revolutionary battery and hydrogen systems in-house. But in fact, many key components were just bought elsewhere or simply didn't exist. Prosecutors later stated unequivocally that Milton knew the truck did not work.
Unbelievable.
The consequences for Nikola and Milton were severe. The company went public via a SPAC, that's a special purpose acquisition company.
Right, the faster way to go public.
Exactly, a shell company that acquires a private one. Nikola reached over a $20 billion market cap before a damning 2020 short seller report meticulously exposed the deception. That led to investigations, Milton's resignation. Milton was indicted in 2021, convicted of fraud in 2022, got a four-year prison sentence, and owes $167 million to Nikola in restitution. The company's stock just plummeted, partnerships dissolved, and its reputation was severely damaged. Another symbol of misleading tech claims in the pursuit of valuation.
And it's not just about physical products or blood tests. The software and AI space, as you mentioned, has also seen its share of deceptive practices. Builder.ai is a key example here, touching on that hot topic of AI.
Right, Builder.ai. They heavily hyped an AI-powered platform for building apps, claiming its proprietary AI largely automated software development. They projected this image of cutting-edge innovation that would disrupt traditional software development, promising to build apps cheaper and faster using their advanced AI.
But the reality, again, was far less automated than they claimed.
Much less. Most of the development work was actually done by human engineers behind the scenes, directly contradicting their core claim of AI automation. More critically, though, Builder.ai inflated its revenue figures to maintain that coveted $1.5 billion unicorn valuation. They overstated revenue by about 300% from 2021 to 2024 through manipulative financial practices like round-tripping.
It's round-tripping, exactly.
It's essentially where money is moved through various related entities to create the illusion of legitimate sales when no real new business is happening. They also used outright fake sales agreements. They meticulously created this mirage of rapid growth just to keep investors engaged and pouring money in.
Wow.
And despite internal red flags that were reportedly just dismissed, Builder.ai successfully raised over $450
million. $450
million. Yeah. But then in early 2025, an independent audit revealed the extent of the inflation. Actual sales were around $50 million versus a claimed $220 million for 2024. Just a massive discrepancy.
Huge gap.
The CEO was forced out, and in May 2025, the company filed for insolvency, with over $500 million in investor funds likely wiped out. U.S. prosecutors and the SEC promptly launched fraud probes. This is a powerful example of AI washing, where a company claims to use advanced AI when, in reality, most of the work is manual or uses much simpler systems.
Right, slapping an AI label on it.
Exactly. And it highlights how due diligence, that crucial investigation investors do, can spectacularly fail amidst FOMO-driven investment frenzies, that fear of missing out.
FOMO, yeah.
Which can push investors to act too quickly without enough scrutiny, especially in a booming sector like AI. They're scared they'll miss the next big thing.
Okay, one more quick case before we move to solutions. Aussie Media. This one highlights how even digital content platforms, which might seem less complex, can fall into the same trap.
Absolutely. Aussie's leadership grossly misrepresented its audience size, its growth metrics, and its business deals, all to secure investments. They desperately wanted to appear much larger and more influential than they actually were, just to attract more capital and prestige in the media world.
And they took it to an extreme, almost unbelievable level. Didn't the COO impersonate someone?
Yes. In one of the most brazen acts, Uzi's COO impersonated a YouTube executive on a confidential call with Goldman Sachs, trying to falsely claim a successful, lucrative deal had been secured.
No way.
Yes. Uzi also provided falsified web traffic numbers, wildly overstated revenue projections, and claimed non-existent partnerships with giants like Google and even Oprah Winfrey. The level of fabrication was just astounding.
That's just wild.
And then a bombshell 2021 New York Times expose meticulously revealed the impersonation and the broader pattern of deception that led directly to Ozzy's rapid shutdown. The CEO, Carlos Watson, was subsequently arrested in 2023, convicted of fraud in 2024, and received a nearly 10-year prison sentence. The company completely collapsed, reputation irreparably tarnished. These cases, all of them, serve as stark, unequivocal warnings. They demonstrate that the relentless pursuit of growth at all costs, especially when achieved through misrepresentation, can lead to catastrophic personal ruin, severe legal penalties, and devastating financial losses for everyone involved. The consequences are very, very real.
They really are. These stories clearly show that the fake it till you make it mentality, particularly when it involves outright product misrepresentation, has severe, far-reaching consequences. So, okay, what's the alternative? How do you build something real, even if it's small, that truly attracts legitimate interest and sustainable investment without resorting to deception? This brings us to the solution: embracing the true minimum viable product, the MVP, and other lean tactics.
Embracing the true MVP and lean tactics.
Indeed. And the traditional understanding of an MVP, well, it's often been profoundly misconstrued, frankly, which has led many teams astray.
How so?
Well, many mistakenly assume that an MVP is simply release one, you know, the first fully functional version of a product that gets launched live to users. But that's not always the case, and it's certainly not the original intention behind the concept. And getting that wrong is often the very first step towards that fake product mentality we just talked about.
You just said the traditional understanding is often misconstrued. That's a pretty strong statement. Can you maybe give us an example of how it's misused in common practice, like a common mistake founders make, before you tell us the true definition? Because I think many of us listening might actually be guilty of that misunderstanding.
That's a great question, and it's a very common pitfall. A frequent misuse of MVP is when a team spends months, maybe 6 months, building a product with, say, a dozen features. They plan a big splashy launch, and they call that their MVP.
Right, the big reveal.
Exactly. They've poured in significant resources, time, money, only to discover after launch that users don't actually need or want half the features. Or maybe that the core problem they thought they were solving isn't actually painful enough for customers to pay for. They've essentially built a full-fledged product when they should have built an experiment. They aimed for perfection instead of aiming for learning.
Okay, so it's not about what you launch necessarily, but about what you learn. That's a fundamental shift in perspective, isn't it? So if release one isn't always the MVP, what is it then? What's the true original definition from the lean startup movement? What's the real game changer about how we should define an MVP that founders so often miss?
The truly transformative insight from the lean startup movement, really pioneered by Eric Ries, is that an MVP isn't a miniature product. It's a maximum learning experiment.
Maximum learning experiment. Okay.
Yes. The core idea of an MVP is that it's the simplest reasonable representation of your product idea that maximizes feedback on your core value proposition and does so at minimal cost and effort. Put simply, an MVP is explicitly an experiment. It's built to test a business idea, a hypothesis, quickly and efficiently.
Okay.
It's about gaining valuable knowledge, not necessarily deploying a complete polished product. The profound takeaway is this: the goal isn't just to build a thing. The goal is to learn if the thing should be built at all and how it should evolve before you've sunk months or maybe even years into it.
A maximum learning experiment, not necessarily a fully launched product. That sounds significantly different from what many people assume. It implies a willingness to be wrong, right? To pivot or even to discard an idea without feeling like you've failed.
Exactly. That's the power of it.
Yeah.
If the experiment fails, meaning your hypothesis about customer needs or market demand is disproven, the team should be willing, even eager, to reject or rework the idea without having wasted significant resources.
Right. Failure is data.
Failure is data. The beauty of a true MVP is that it provides incredibly valuable knowledge, even if that knowledge is this initial idea isn't worth pursuing without the massive investment in time and money that a full product launch would entail.
Yeah.
It's fundamentally about de-risking your venture through rapid validated learning. You find out what not to build just as much as what to build.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so given that understanding, how do we define what that MVP should be for us, for our specific idea? How do you distill a big vision into that minimal experiment, especially when you might have, you know, dozens of potential features or directions?
Right. To effectively identify and scope your MVP, you can ask yourself four key questions. These really force you to narrow your focus and define your learning objective. First, What's the specific idea you're considering? Is it a whole product, a new feature, or service? Defining this clearly sets your scope.
Okay, scope it.
Second, and this is absolutely critical for focus, what is the unique value proposition? What unique, compelling value does your idea offer to its target audience? This ensures that what you build actually addresses a specific, hopefully acute, need.
Value prop, got it.
Third, what specific feedback do you need to gather? What insights will definitively tell you if that value proposition is truly valuable to customers, or if your underlying assumptions about their problem and your proposed solution are actually correct?
What do we need to learn? Okay.
And finally, fourth, how can you create the simplest yet most practical representation that maximizes that specific feedback? This last question is crucial because it pushes you to innovate on how you test. Sometimes, yes, a live coded launch is necessary, but often a low-fidelity prototype or a very simplified version, maybe even something manual, can provide all the insights you need without the full investment of developing and launching code.
Can you give a concrete real-world example of that last one? A scenario where the MVP isn't what you'd typically expect, where the test mechanism is completely different from the final product vision?
Certainly. Let's revisit that example of a grocery store wanting to explore, offering cheap drone delivery for small orders.
Okay.
Their value proposition might be, customers want to restock groceries affordably without leaving home. Now, to test market demand and customer satisfaction for this idea, not the drone technology itself.
Right.
A simple MVP wouldn't be building a fleet of drones.
Right. That sounds expensive.
Very expensive. Instead, the MVP might be having people, maybe existing staff or gig workers, deliver those same small grocery orders with reduced fees. You're manually simulating the core service.
Ah, okay. Humans as drones, basically.
Exactly, for the test. This gets the needed feedback on actual customer demand, the optimal delivery fees, overall satisfaction with the service itself, much faster and far, far cheaper than building or buying drones and deploying them. Makes sense. It's a powerful lesson in not overbuilding. You learn if the core value proposition resonates before you invest potentially millions in drone technology. This approach is true to the spirit of lean because you can quickly rule out the idea if you learn it's not actually valuable to users without wasting the team's precious time pursuing a costly technological solution that maybe nobody wants.
That's a truly brilliant illustration. It really shows how the core of the idea can be tested without the most complex, most expensive part of the solution being built first. And that concept of iterative learning and rapid experimentation brings us directly to these product development methodologies like Agile UX and Lean UX. They seem to go hand in hand with the whole idea of MVPs. How do Agile UX and Lean UX relate to each other, and how do they inform what we're discussing today?
Yeah, they're closely related. Both Agile UX and Lean UX have their foundations firmly rooted in Agile software development principles, and both are deeply user-centric. They prioritize understanding the user and adapting the product based on feedback. They both move away from that heavy upfront planning and extensive documentation, instead favoring continuous discovery. Both also use iterative cycles for development and involve all key stakeholders, product owners, designers, developers, even customers throughout the entire process. Ultimately, they both aim for continuous product discovery, making sure the product evolves responsively to meet actual user needs rather than just static initial assumptions.
So if they're so similar in their core principles and goals, where's the key difference? It sounds like there may be two sides of the same coin, but one must have a particular emphasis that makes it more relevant to our discussion today about avoiding those fake products.
You're right. The distinction lies primarily in their emphasis. While Agile UX prioritizes user testing and research throughout the development sprints, meaning it integrates user insights at basically every step of the cycle to refine features as they're built. Lean UX focuses even more heavily on those learning loops through building MVPs. In Lean UX, the absolute emphasis is on getting a minimal functional product or even just a specific test into users' hands as quickly as humanly possible. Why? To validate core hypotheses and gather immediate, actionable feedback.
Got it. Speed to learning.
Exactly. Speed to validated learning. This feedback then directly informs the next iteration, making that cycle of build, measure, learn incredibly tight and fast.
That emphasis on building MVPs in Lean UX sounds directly fundamentally relevant to avoiding the fake product trap we just discussed. It's all about turning ideas into something tangible for testing, right? Rather than just showing concepts or, you know, slick mock-ups.
It absolutely is the antidote. The core advantages, the pros of Lean UX, directly support this proactive, reality-based approach to product development. First, it fosters continuous learning through its cyclical idea design build learn pattern. This ensures ongoing, validated insights from actual user interaction. You're constantly checking your assumptions against reality. Second, it intrinsically builds customer feedback into the core of the design and development process. The priority is getting that MVP into customers' hands quickly to get that crucial, unbiased feedback. This customer centricity, by its very definition, helps prevent building something nobody wants or needs.
Makes sense.
And third, a really powerful benefit, it helps prevent the curse of knowledge. This is such a critical point for any product team. Your team knows everything about your product, right? Its intricacies, its vision, but your customers don't.
Right. We live and breathe it. They don't.
Exactly. By involving users extremely early with a functional MVP, teams learn alongside their customers. They avoid the trap of assuming they know what users want or understand, and therefore avoid building features that are either not needed, confusing, or simply don't solve the real problem. It forces you out of your internal echo chamber.
Those are significant advantages for building real products and truly understanding your market. But, you know, no methodology is perfect. Are there any downsides to Lean UX that people should be aware of? Or maybe potential pitfalls to avoid when adopting this approach?
Yes, absolutely. While Lean UX strongly promotes practical builds and rapid testing, if it's not managed carefully, the depth of user research can sometimes suffer if it becomes too informal or maybe too shallow.
Ah, okay. Speed over depth.
Potentially. There is a risk that teams might build and test without sufficient deep, structured user research up front, relying solely on quick, maybe superficial feedback. This can lead to something called local optimization, where you iterate rapidly on what might be a fundamentally flawed core idea, rather than taking a step back and pivoting to a truly better one.
Refining the wrong thing.
Exactly. There's also a risk of making too many untested foundational assumptions early on about the product or its users that are never truly challenged because you're moving so fast. And finally, if teams don't genuinely understand that curse of knowledge concept, or if they prioritize sheer speed above true user empathy, they can still end up building products or features customers don't truly want or understand, even if they're built quickly. The emphasis on speed sometimes tempts teams to cut corners on that deeper, empathetic user understanding.
Okay, so given the strong foundation in Lean MVP principles and the Lean UX approach, with its pros and cons, what are the actionable strategies? What are the tactics for building real, impactful MVPs rather than just faking it? What should our listeners do, practically, to make sure they're on the right path?
Okay, so the path really involves four critical tactics. When you implement these diligently and consistently, they help ensure you build genuine value, not just illusion. These tactics guide you right from validating the problem through to measuring success. The first tactic is to deep dive into problem validation and user research. This is absolutely where it all begins.
This sounds like step one, the absolute foundation. Don't just build what you think people want, verify it first. Seems obvious, but it's often overlooked, isn't it? Especially when founders are passionate about their solution.
Exactly. It's a fundamental, often catastrophic mistake founders make, skipping thorough user research and just assuming they already know what their users want or what problems they face. Instead, you must engage in thorough market research. This includes broad surveys, maybe to identify trends, but much more importantly, in-depth user interviews.
Talking to people.
Talking to real potential users to uncover their actual frustrations, their unmet needs, the emotional context around those problems. You also need comprehensive competitive analysis to understand what existing solutions are out there, their strengths, their weaknesses, and where the genuine market gaps lie.
Okay.
And, critically, you must validate that the problem you're trying to solve actually exists, is painful enough, and is significant enough for people to genuinely care about finding a solution before you even jump to designing or building that solution. You have to confirm the pain point is real, it's acute, and it's widespread enough to build a business around. Otherwise, you're just building a solution in search of a problem.
Right. Solution looking for a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so once you've validated the problem, the second tactic then is to define your MVP strategically. This is about narrowing the focus, making it manageable, I assume. But how do you decide what actually makes it into that initial very lean experiment?
Precisely. The MVP should focus intensely on a single core value proposition. It should aim to do just one thing exceptionally well to address that specific validated problem.
One thing well.
One thing well. This means you must ruthlessly avoid feature overload or feature creep. You need to prioritize features with extreme discipline, using established frameworks like Moscow, You remember that one?
Yeah, must have, should have.
Exactly. Must have, should have, could have, won't have features. It's a simple but really powerful prioritization method. The must-haves are the absolute non-negotiables that deliver that core value. Everything else can, and probably should, wait for a later iteration.
So you don't even need a fully functional coded product right away to define that MVP. Could it be something even simpler than code?
Not at all. In fact, it's often highly advisable to start with a low-fidelity approach to test your core hypothesis first. Consider methods like simple landing pages, just to gauge interest in your proposed solution before it's even built. You can gather email signups, maybe pre-orders.
Test demand.
Exactly. Or try fake door tests. This is where you might add a button or a link in an existing product or on a website for a feature that doesn't actually exist yet. You just see how many people click on it, expressing interest.
It's clever.
Or even paper prototypes to quickly visualize a user flow and gather feedback on the interaction design itself. These lo-fi methods allow you to test the core value proposition and gather that initial crucial feedback without significant development costs or time investment. They're quick, cheap experiments to validate demand and user experience before a single line of code is written.
That makes perfect sense for testing an idea quickly. Okay, the third tactic then is to embrace rapid iteration and validated learning. This brings us right back to that experiment idea you mentioned earlier, that cycle of building and learning and how that truly drives progress.
Yes, it's the very heart of the lean startup methodology, that continuous loop of build, measure, learn. You build the MVP, then you rigorously measure its effectiveness through both quantitative data and direct user feedback, and finally you learn from those insights to iterate and improve the product. It's a continuous dynamic cycle of refinement, not just a linear progression. You're constantly refining your understanding of the user and the problem.
How do you get that feedback effectively? What tools or methods are best for gathering those insights, both the why and the what, to ensure you're truly learning and not just guessing?
Well, you should leverage existing tools and platforms whenever possible to build and test quickly and efficiently, minimizing your time and cost. For the feedback itself, you need to gather both qualitative feedback things like detailed customer interviews and usability tests to understand the user experiences, their motivations, their underlying pain points. That's the why behind their actions.
That's the why.
And you also need quantitative feedback using analytics tools to track actual user behavior. Things like engagement rates, retention rates, conversion rates. This gives you statistical insights, the what people are doing.
The what, got it.
Crucially, you must then act on this feedback, but with discernment. Don't just blindly implement every suggestion you get. You need to prioritize changes based on their potential impact on user value and your core product goals. And, maybe most importantly, be prepared to pivot your product, or maybe even your entire business model, if the data tells you your initial assumptions were fundamentally incorrect. Learning that an assumption is wrong is still a huge success in this framework because it prevents you from building the wrong thing for the wrong market.
Right, pivoting isn't failure, it's learning. And the fourth and final tactic is to set clear objectives and success metrics for your MVP. So you need to know what winning looks like before you even start the experiment. How do you actually define that success?
Absolutely. Before you launch your MVP, you must clearly define the measurable goals and the key performance indicators, KPIs, that will indicate whether it's succeeding or failing. These could be specific user engagement rates, maybe conversion rates, like from a free trial to a paid plan, customer satisfaction scores, like Net Promoter Score or NPS, or even just the number of users signing up for a waiting list if it's very early.
Okay, tangible numbers.
Tangible numbers. And these metrics must align directly with your broader business objectives. You need to show how a successful MVP contributes to your overall company goals. You need to establish a metrics-driven development cycle to guide your process, help you prioritize features, and measure the impact of every single change you make. This disciplined approach ensures that every iteration is purposeful and contributes to validated learning, preventing you from just building features for building's sake. Applying Lean MVP, strategies for AI startups and beyond.
Okay, these four tactics: problem validation, strategic MVP definition, rapid iteration, and clear metrics, they seem universally applicable really to any kind of product development. But our sources specifically highlight how crucial these real, minimally functional MVPs are for early stage AI startups. Why is that particularly important in the AI space?
There's just so much hype around AI right now.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a prime area for, well, fake products and overpromising.
You've really hit on a critical point there, and it cuts through a lot of the current AI hype. In the AI domain, because there's immense hype, The skepticism from savvy investors and crucial partners is actually even higher than in some other tech sectors.
Right, they've seen the hype cycles before.
Exactly. So a working prototype, even a limited one, cuts through all that noise by showcasing actual AI outputs and real user interactions. This builds tangible proof and trust, and it directly helps avoid those ethical and legal pitfalls of overpromising that we saw in cases like Builder.ai.
It's fundamentally about delivering genuine value, even if that value is limited in scope initially, or maybe even partially manual behind the scenes, as long as it solves a genuine pain point for a user. Investors and partners, they aren't really looking for AI ideas anymore. They're looking for AI results. The proof is in the working product, not just the PowerPoint deck.
So how do AI startups, or really any startup applying these principles, put this into practice to attract those key stakeholders like design partners and investors? Let's start with design partners, especially in complex enterprise or government sectors. They're often very cautious. They have high demands. How do you get them to trust an early stage AI solution that obviously isn't fully mature yet?
Yeah, that's a key challenge. For attracting enterprise and government design partners, the first and probably most effective strategy is to deliver a narrow functional pilot. Instead of trying to build the whole sprawling platform that handles every conceivable use case.
Boiling the ocean.
Right. Don't try to boil the ocean. Implement just one critical feature or maybe one specific workflow end to end. Focus on a specific high value problem for that particular partner and just make that one thing work reliably.
Okay, an example.
Okay, so a healthcare AI startup, for instance, could focus only on automating a specific part of medical chart reviews. Maybe they process synthetic patient records first, or a small batch of real anonymized data just to accurately flag specific issues. That proves the core concept for that single high-value workflow. This approach demonstrates concrete value very quickly for a specific problem the partner deeply cares about, making it tangible and much, much easier for them to say yes to engaging further.
That makes perfect sense for demonstrating focused value, but what about integration? Getting it into their often complex and frankly rigid enterprise systems, that sounds like a huge hurdle for a lean MVP from a small early stage company. These aren't simple consumer apps that just stand alone.
That's precisely where founders can get clever and leverage low-code tools for quick integration. You don't necessarily need a massive engineering effort for those initial pilots. Platforms like Bubble or Retool, for instance, they allow you to build functional web applications and dashboards with minimal traditional coding. This lets you spin up simple interfaces that your AI can power pretty quickly.
Okay.
Or you might build simple chatbots in common enterprise collaboration platforms like Slack or Microsoft Teams that can interface directly with your AI model. Furthermore, services like Zapier or Make, these allow rapid connection between different applications and automate workflows. They let you quickly connect to existing data sources and systems without needing deep, complex API integrations.
Ah, connect the dots easily.
Exactly. This means the partner gets a hands-on demo or pilot without a long, heavy deployment cycle. It makes the MVP feel more real because it actually integrates, even lightly, into their environment. And it signals your ability to adapt and integrate with their existing systems, which builds immense confidence in your agility and your practicality.
That's clever, using existing infrastructure to sort of bridge the gap. But what if the AI itself isn't fully built out or truly autonomous yet? Is it okay to still show it to a partner if, you know, a human is doing some of the work behind the scenes? Isn't that getting close to faking it again?
That's a really crucial distinction, and the answer is absolutely yes, it's okay, as long as you're transparent about the beta or pilot nature of it.
Transparency is key.
Transparency is absolutely key. You can, and often should, use human in the loop and Wizard of Oz tactics. This means humans are quietly supporting your MVP's AI features in the early stages, ensuring the partner ultimately gets the promised outcome.
Okay, like the wizard behind the curtain.
Exactly. For an AI report writing tool, for example, you might initially have a human manually compile parts of the report or fix the AI's output while the AI is still learning. Enterprise partners generally prioritize a solution that works and solves their problem over one that's perfectly fully automated on day one.
Right. Results matter most.
Results matter most. You just need to be transparent by framing it clearly as a beta or a pilot so they understand some processes aren't fully built out or autonomous yet. This provides immediate value and validates the solution while you gradually automate those human-in-the-loop components. It's about delivering results first, then scaling the technology behind it.
And what about the data? AI needs data to learn and perform. How do you handle that with a lean approach, especially when Getting large, clean data sets is often a huge barrier for early-stage AI companies.
Yeah, data is often the bottleneck. The strategy here is to design data workflows that solve a specific pain point using whatever data is realistically accessible. Even if your ultimate vision involves sophisticated machine learning models trained on, petabytes of data, your MVP might start with much simpler data analytics or even just rule-based systems.
Simpler can work.
Simpler can absolutely work initially. You might manually gather a small subset of their data, run a straightforward analysis, or maybe use a pre-trained general purpose model. The key is to showcase results on their real data, even if it's just a small sample, to make the value concrete and directly relevant to their actual operations. There's a critical piece of advice I've heard from experienced AI builders. Not every AI needs GPT-4. Sometimes a dumb rule-based model does the job, or a simple classifier. Pick what works, not what sounds fancy. The partner will appreciate a reliable, simple solution that solves their immediate problem far more than an ambitious one that isn't ready or breaks constantly.
That's great advice. Focus on what works. And then once you've shown them this minimal functional pilot using their data, you just iterate, iterate, iterate. Is that how you build those long-term relationships and eventually convert them into full-paying clients?
Exactly.
You engage these early design customers as true collaborators through rapid iteration based directly on their feedback. Update your minimal MVP in days or weeks, not months, based directly on their input. Show them progress quickly.
Agility.
That agility proves you can respond quickly to their specific needs and integrate their feedback rapidly, which is incredibly rare for large, established vendors. This responsiveness is very impressive to early partners. It builds immense confidence and significantly increases the likelihood they'll become paying customers, passionate advocates, and powerful references for your future clients. They feel invested in your success because you're genuinely listening and adapting to them.
That covers design partners really well. Now, moving on to investors, especially at that crucial pre-seed or seed stage, they're often looking for, huge returns, disruptive technology. How do you convince them your early AI idea is investable without a complete, fully functional product? It seems like a potentially tough sell when maybe everyone else is promising the moon.
Yeah, it's a different pitch. When pitching investors at these early stages, you need to prototype the core AI functionality. Identify the single most critical capability your AI product absolutely must have, and implement a basic but working version of it.
Show the core works.
Show the core works. Investors don't necessarily need a full feature set at this point, but they do want undeniable proof that the core technology is viable, or at least that you've significantly de-risked its fundamental feasibility. For instance, for an AI contract analyzer, maybe just show a simple Python script or a basic model correctly extracting just a few key clauses from a sample document.
Okay.
You can use off-the-shelf components. You can fine-tune existing openly available models from platforms like Hugging Face for various models, or maybe OpenAI's API for powerful language models. You can even use manual Wizard of Oz processes initially to simulate the outcome. The goal is just to show specific, measurable results, like our prototype processed 50 sample contracts and automatically flagged 95% of the risky clauses.
Concrete results.
Concrete results. VCs don't back AI ideas anymore. They back AI results. A live, albeit maybe rudimentary, technical demo can be incredibly powerful for validating that your idea is grounded in reality.
But investors expect a polished demo, don't they? They're seeing a lot of slick presentations, sophisticated simulations. How do you stand out with a lean prototype that might not look as visually impressive on the surface?
That's a fair point. While the back end and the underlying technology can be simplistic, you absolutely can, and probably should, use low-code, no-code tools to create a polished demo experience. Wrap your functional MVP in a user-friendly interface using tools like Streamlit for quick data apps or Webflow for a clickable web application.
Make it look good.
Make it look good. Make it feel real. Or if a live interactive demo is too complex initially, even a short, well-produced screen recording showcasing the functionality can be highly effective. Remember the famous Dropbox MVP?
Yeah, the video.
It wasn't a working app initially.
Yeah.
It was just a video demo explaining the concept clearly, and it attracted massive user interest and signups based on that alone. Similarly, Midjourney, the AI image generator, launched initially just as a Discord bot. It delivered its service via chat to validate demand quickly without a fancy custom UI.
Interesting.
The goal is to make the vision feel real and exciting without requiring heavy, time-consuming engineering investment upfront. A bit of polish on a minimal, but functional demo goes a very long way to make the product vision feel tangible and exciting.
So similar to the design partners, for investors, you also focus on one thing first, one very specific problem or use case.
Yes, exactly. You focus on one compelling use case and aim for a measurable win. Investors get wary, and rightly so, when a startup claims to do everything or solve every problem under the sun.
Too broad, too early.
Too broad, too early. Instead, articulate a very specific, narrow wedge into the market that your MVP clearly addresses. For instance, instead of saying, "Our AI will automate all customer support," you might show, "Our AI currently handles common password reset queries with 90% accuracy, reducing human support tickets by, say, 15% for our beta tester."
Much more concrete.
Much more concrete. It's far more achievable, it's easier to validate, and it's faster to build. And crucially, attach a specific, measurable success metric to that use case. Investors love metrics. If your minimal product can deliver even a small scale, but real, quantifiable result that moves a needle for a customer, highlight that relentlessly. A focused early win not only validates your core concept, but also strongly hints at broader potential once you expand into adjacent use cases.
Does that mean building the core AI from scratch isn't actually necessary at this pre-seed or seed stage? A lot of founders might think they need some groundbreaking proprietary AI from day one to truly impress investors.
Often, building AI from scratch at this stage is not only undesirable, but completely unnecessary and potentially a waste of precious resources. You should leverage off-the-shelf AI and data smartly. Show investors you can cleverly use existing models from platforms like Hugging Face or utilize powerful pre-trained models via services like OpenAI's API.
Use what's available.
Use what's available. You can even use synthetic data for training or testing, particularly in highly regulated fields where real data is hard to get. This kind of frugality is actually very attractive to early-stage investors. It shows you're capital efficient, you're resourceful, and you're singularly focused on proving business value first, rather than embarking on expensive, time-consuming foundational AI research and development that could probably be deferred until after you've secured more capital. It demonstrates resourceful, pragmatic execution over, say, academic ambition.
Okay, so beyond the tech demo itself, what's the ultimate validation for investors? What truly speaks volumes that maybe even the most impressive demo can't quite capture on its own?
Nothing speaks louder than showing early users or design partner traction. Real-world validation.
Traction.
Traction. Even a handful of enthusiastic early adopters, maybe a compelling testimonial from a beta user, or an established pilot program with a known company or a government agency. Early revenue, even if it's minimal, is absolute gold. But even significant unpaid usage or clear letters of intent, LOIs, from potential customers can significantly strengthen your case.
Even letters of intent help.
Absolutely. We've seen examples where a startup attracted, say, 50-plus early adopters in a single month with just a lean AI prototype, and that demonstrable interest alone helped raise capital. Another example is EasyFill, which secured funding and customers with just a prototype that automatically filled forms. These examples show that a functional MVP combined with initial user interest creates this virtuous cycle. It demonstrates that people actually want this and use it, not just that the technology works in theory in a lab.
Right. Real people using it. And then finally, you connect it all back to the big vision you started with. How does this small functional piece fit into the grander plan to really excite investors about the future potential?
Precisely. You demonstrate vision with execution. Your MVP isn't the final destination. It acts as this crucial, validated bridge between your present capabilities and your grand future vision.
The bridge, okay.
You walk investors through the specific user journey and the problem solved with the current MVP, clearly articulating the immediate value delivered. Then you zoom out. You explain how this initial success expands into a much bigger business, how this particular piece of AI or functionality is foundational to that expansion.
Sure.
And because you've actually built something real, you can answer detailed practical questions about how the solution works, what you've learned from early users, and how you realistically plan to improve and scale. This shows integrity and commitment. You were serious enough to build before asking for money.
Right. You put skin in the game.
Exactly. Investors can then more confidently believe that with their capital, you can actually scale that initial validated execution into the broader vision. Many successful AI startups started with a very limited beta, earned a few enthusiastic users, and used that compelling story to raise significant funds.
Mm-hmm.
They effectively conveyed, look, we've done this much in 3 months with just two people. Imagine what we'll achieve in 18 months with your investment. It really is about showing, not just telling.
Oh, true. So there you have it. The contrast, well, it couldn't be starker, could it? On one side, you've got the tempting mirage of a fake product built on hype and exaggerated claims, a path that, as we've seen, so often leads to spectacular downfall, sometimes criminal charges, and ruined reputations. It's a road paved with perhaps good intentions initially, but often ending in disaster.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you have the steady trust-building power of the minimally functional maximum learning MVP. It really feels like a choice between illusion and reality, doesn't it? Between fleeting hype and enduring value.
It truly is. It's about replacing that dangerous temptation for high-fidelity faking with a laser focus on authentic, albeit maybe minimal, creation. By starting small, by making it real, and by focusing relentlessly on validated learning, you create genuine value early on.
Right.
You solve actual painful problems for those crucial early design partners, building essential relationships. And you provide concrete, undeniable proof to investors that your team can actually execute, not just theorize or dream. And this isn't just about proving technical feasibility. It's about proving your team's integrity, your adaptability, and your ability to deliver.
And this approach, it isn't just about avoiding catastrophic disaster like we saw in those cases. It's fundamentally about building a solid, honest foundation for long-term sustainable success. It means you iterate and you evolve based on real-world feedback and hard data, which is just absolutely invaluable, especially in complex and rapidly evolving domains like artificial intelligence, where, you know, theoretical solutions often completely fail when they face the messy reality of real-world data and unpredictable user behavior.
What's truly fascinating here, and I think that it's perhaps the most powerful takeaway from all of this, is that the core message is remarkably consistent. Whether you're building a groundbreaking AI system or a relatively simple productivity app, the advice is the same. If you want people to believe in your AI, your product, your service, show them it works.
Show, don't just tell.
Exactly. That simple truth cuts through all the noise, all the hype, and provides a clear, ethical, and ultimately more successful pathway forward for any founder or any product team out there.
And that's not just for AI, is it? For your idea, your product, your service, whatever it is that you listening are dreaming of building. Maybe ask yourself, what does it truly do right now for someone? What is the smallest, most tangible proof of value you can create today or this week? And crucially, how can you show it, not just tell people about it? That's the core challenge, isn't it? And maybe the greatest opportunity to build something real and lasting in a world that I think increasingly values authenticity over illusion.